proceed to the third case of the day, Hackett versus Xerox Long-Term Disability. Mr. Dabowski. May proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Mark Dabowski. I represent the appellant, James Hackett. Against more than an 11-year history of benefit payments to Mr. Hackett, supported by independent medical examinations and testing, a finding of disability by the Social Security Administration, and continuous ongoing treatment by Dr. John Gerber, a board-certified psychiatrist, whose ongoing reports established a deeply ingrained maladaptive personality disorder that was resistant to any kind of medical treatment, Xerox suddenly discontinued Mr. Hackett's benefits in January 1999 based on a 45-minute examination by another psychiatrist who was completely unfamiliar with the 11-year history of Mr. Hackett receiving benefits.
Mr. Kozofsky, I wonder if you could pause right there for a minute and address your opponent's argument that Mr. Hackett had been asked to bring all of those relevant records to his appointment with Dr. Holloman and didn't do so, number one, and number two, whatever the flaws in the original appointment were, that Dr. Holloman did in fact eventually review those records.
We responded to the first point, Your Honor, in our brief. We indicated that in the record in this case, in Mr. Hackett's affidavit, he supplied a letter that he had written to Xerox, to Health International, indicating that he did not have those records to bring with him. Health International's letter to Dr. Holloman indicated that either they or Mr. Hackett would supply the records, but that he was not to proceed with the examination, and his examination would not be considered unless he contemporaneously reviewed the records at the time of his examination, which of course did not take place.
How much time was there between the moment when Mr. Hackett knew he was supposed to have the examination with Dr. Holloman and when the examination actually occurred?
I believe there was approximately a two-week period there, Your Honor. Now, with respect to the second point, as far as Dr. Holloman reviewing documents later, Dr. Holloman only reviewed some of the documents. Dr. Holloman never really got a true sense of the 11-year chronological and longitudinal history of this case, where starting in 1987, Mr. Hackett was put on disability by Xerox at their own doctor's request, their own in-house doctor's request. Mr. Hackett thought he could come back to work a year later. Xerox said, no, not until you have a fitness for duty evaluation. Mr. Hackett underwent that evaluation. That evaluation determined that Mr. Hackett was not fit to return to work. So did a subsequent examination by Dr. Hani. So did a subsequent examination by Dr. Bennett. So did several other examinations that were conducted based on doctors to whom Mr. Hackett was referred by the Social Security Administration, and ultimately Dr. Gerber's opinions, in which he relied on those concurring opinions from all of the other doctors who agreed with his position, contrary to the position taken by Dr. Holloman.
I know there are a number of reports, and I am not clear in my own mind which ones, if taking your comment that Dr. Holloman saw some but not all, which he saw and which he was missing.
Dr. Holloman saw, according to the record, the psychological evaluation that was done by Dr. Hemrich. He saw the psychiatric evaluation that was performed by Dr. Janet Bennett in the year 1992. And he saw Dr. Gerber's report to Administrative Law Judge John Brundage for the Social Security Administration that was prepared in 1995. He did not see the independent medical examination that was performed by Dr. Edward Wolpert in 1988. He did not see Dr. John Hanney's examination that was performed later. He did not see the reports from Dr. Brunstetter, Xerox's in-house physician. He did not see the report from Dr. Geller, who succeeded Dr. Brunstetter. He did not see the report from Dr. Richard Koenig, who was examined Mr. Hackett for Social Security in 1994. And he did not see the final Social Security examination, which is in this record at page 22 of the administrative record, by Dr. Terrence McGovern, who administered psychological testing to Mr. Hackett. All of those reports were entirely consistent with Dr. Gerber's opinions, which is why we have argued very strenuously in this case that the treating physician's opinion is entitled to control.
Could I ask, I mean, one of the premises of your argument is that ultimately it was Xerox's burden to make sure that those reports were in front of the doctor on whose opinions they were relying. Where do you get that from?
From the contract that Health International had signed with Xerox, that they were going to conduct a full and fair review in compliance with the ERISA fiduciary standards. But even if that were not the case, Xerox itself or Health International never had all of the records. They've conceded in correspondence to Mr. Hackett's counsel that they never had all of the records relating to the 11 years that Mr. Hackett received benefits. And nowhere in the entire administrative record can it be discerned that anybody at Health International or Xerox reviewed all of the medical records in making a reasoned determination. We have cited considerable authority, starting with this court's Halpin decision from 1992, and including another case involving Xerox from the Second Circuit, the Krakow versus Xerox case, although we cited more fully the district court opinion in that case, that it is the plan administrator's burden under ERISA to conduct a full and fair review. They cannot just defer to one opinion or another opinion. They must consider all of the evidence in the record, weigh that evidence, and articulate reasons for rejecting particular evidence. Nowhere in this record is there any articulation whatsoever of any reason for rejecting Dr. Gerber's opinion. Dr. Holman reached a different conclusion, although Dr. Holman's opinion that Mr. Hackett was capable of returning to work has to be qualified by the three factors that he checked off on the form in which he indicated, as Dr. Gerber did, that Mr. Hackett would have tremendous problems dealing with supervisors or coworkers or responding to direction. How on earth can a 62-year-old man function at any job when he's been out of the workforce for 12 years, when he is unable to respond to criticism, to coworkers, to supervision, to instruction, to direction? In addition to that, the record indicates...
Sounds like the only job he's suited for is a federal judge, but go ahead.
Even this court responds to supervision by the Supreme Court, so he wouldn't qualify.
Adversely, but we do it.
but based on that, there was just no reasoned basis in this record for Xerox to have reached the conclusion that Mr. Hackett was no longer entitled to benefits. For 11 years, they received reports from the same Dr. John Gerber who said, this man is seriously disabled. He has a severe personality disorder. When placed under stress, he would certainly decompensate. And every year, Xerox said, that's fine with us, we agree, we'll certify his disability. All of a sudden, after 11 years, even though there was no evidence whatsoever that Mr. Hackett's condition had improved, benefits are suddenly terminated. That makes absolutely no logical sense. It is inconsistent with this court's decision in Halpin. It is inconsistent with this court's decision in Ladd versus ITT. It is markedly inconsistent with the Ninth Circuit decision that we relied on, the Regula versus Delta case.
But, you know, it looked to me, I mean, this is something your opponents cited, and you mentioned it a bit in your reply brief, that the evidence might have been viewed as more in the balance than you're portraying it. Looking, for instance, at the administrative law judge's opinion in the Social Security disability case, where he finally decides, okay, he's disabled, but I think it should be reevaluated soon. For them to decide, well, now we've had Dr. Holloman, and I understand why you're not talking about Dr. Wolf, but anyway, we have Dr. Holloman taking a new look. It's a few years later. Mental illness is the kind of thing that isn't just a binary phenomenon. It's not like you can't can't do anything or you can now do everything. Sometimes you're somewhere in the middle, and maybe they clearly rely on this more recent opinion. Why can't they have done that on the face of this record?
I think, Your Honor, they could have done that if they had done an adequate job. But here we have a situation where Mr. Hackett was sent to Dr. Holman essentially in an evidentiary vacuum. Dr. Holman really had no idea what he was dealing with at the time that he initially evaluated Mr. Hackett, yet he still found that there were certain restrictions. With respect to Judge Brundage's opinion, we raised 2 points with response to that. First of all, Judge Brundage did conclude that despite his own personal misgivings, that Mr. Hackett was disabled. But secondly, and really more significantly, Judge Brundage is not a physician. Judge Brundage is an administrative law judge. He's entitled to his personal opinions. The fact of the matter is, though, that the medical doctors who saw Mr. Hackett at the time of the disability determination by Social Security and after the time of the disability determination, particularly Dr. Gerber, who reported that he had seen no change whatsoever from the previous 11 years. And those findings were entirely consistent. Every symptom that Dr. Gerber related in 1995, in 1998, and finally in 1999, his last admission to the plan, all raised the same symptoms that Mr. Hackett was suffering from, which prevented him from working. Now, with respect to Dr. Wolf, Dr. Wolf never saw Mr. Hackett. Dr. Wolf has apparently a very close consulting arrangement with Health International. Dr. Wolf, it's not clear what he reviewed. He stated he reviewed a voluminous record. It's not clear what he reviewed, what consideration he gave to the evidence. But as the regular decision points out, he may have been more interested in preserving his consulting arrangement and rather than doing a fair job for Jim Hackett. And under the ERISA statute, under 29 U.S.C. Section 1104, creates a fiduciary obligation on the part of Health International, which it says it assumes in its contract with Xerox, that it has to act as an ERISA fiduciary, and that means that its primary duty is to act in the interest of participants and beneficiaries for the purpose of paying benefits. This court, in its Lay versus Engel decision, talked about that the fiduciary must act with an eye single toward the plan participants in that respect. And there was an absolute total disregard of that or of ERISA's purpose set forth in 29 U.S.C. Section 1001B, that it was enacted to protect participants, to provide them remedies, ready access to the federal courts, and all of that was taken away from Jim Hackett in this case. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Hrabowski. Mr. Faulkner.
May it please the court. My name is Rick Potler. I am from Thompson Coburn in St. Louis, Missouri, and today I have the privilege of speaking on behalf of all of the appellees, although I am not counsel of record for Health International, which I sometimes refer to as HI. This suit concerns a man who claims to be totally disabled because he has the inability to get along with people. In my oral argument, I have the hopes of addressing 6 issues, but having been here before, I appreciate that your agenda may be different than mine. First, I intend to address what is the appropriate standard of review and to show why it is the arbitrary and capricious standard of review. Second, I will explain why Xerox had the right to make prospective changes to its plan, even changes that would affect Mr. Hackett's future benefits and rights. Third, I will explain why Health International's determination in this case was not arbitrary and capricious. Fourth, I will demonstrate that HI substantially complied with ERISA's review requirements, and that in any event, no harm arose as a result of any technical violations. I will explain, if time permits, why Xerox's assistance of Mr. Hackett in obtaining Social Security benefits does not mean that he could not later be found not to be disabled under the disability plan. And finally, if time permits, I will explain why Judge Norgel did not abuse his discretion when he ruled that discovery was not proper in this case.
Mr. Pollard, before you start on that list and depending on how much time permits, we'll see how far you get. Could you spend a little time on our case of Halpin and Granger and try to distinguish that?
Yes, sir.
I think if you could do that, it might be able to help us focus on those other points.
Yes, sir. I'd be happy to do that, Your Honor. I think that when you read Halpin and its progeny, including the Amico case by Judge Posner and the Donato case by Judge Ripple, what you find is the court is concerned about certain things being satisfied. First of all, did the plaintiff or the participant have an opportunity to submit to the decision maker all the materials that he wanted? And there's no dispute about that in this case. Mr. Hackett submitted materials continuously. In fact, there are letters from him or his counsel dated March 31st, April 1st, April 28th, May 19th, and July 9th, all in the administrative record, and the most important of which is the March 31st letter, which is at the administrative record, pages 207 through 209, when he gives a list of documents he is providing, all the past medical history records he wants us to consider, and he takes great exception with the conclusions of Dr. Holman. So he had that opportunity. Second, he has the right to assure that the materials he submits are reviewed so that somebody considers them. And this administrative record establishes that that is, in fact, what happened in this case. In fact, after Dr. Holman initially examined Mr. Hackett sent a letter and included a new opinion from Dr. Gerber, whom he had not seen for more than 2 years, and he also submitted Dr. Bennett's report, and I think also Dr. Hemrich, as Mr. Dabowski acknowledged. Dr. Holman writes a separate little note and says, I've considered all of these materials that were provided. And then in March, he sends additional materials, and Dr. Wolf acknowledges that he considered all of them. So the record establishes that everything that Mr. Hackett submitted was, in fact, considered.
But you know what is troubling? It's hard to find. I guess maybe we are sort of circling in on your third point with Halpin and also this discussion. I can't find anywhere where either Dr. Holman or Dr. Wolf or anybody explains why Mr. Hackett has improved. I also don't see anything that suggests that they just think that all these other doctors were wrong. I mean, I suppose that's another possibility if they reevaluated it and said, you know, there was a diagnosis in the past, but now we've looked at it, and, you know, doctors disagree sometimes with diagnoses. But I can't find that either. And without a sense of change, it seems to me that this record is really inadequate to explain all of a sudden why he doesn't get the benefit.
Well, I appreciate that, Your Honor. I think it's important to look at two things. First of all, when you look at the prior medical record from Dr. Hani, Grossi, Hemrich, Kunkka, they last saw Mr. Hackett in 1989. They saw him one time in 1989. So by the time Dr. Holman sees him, those records are 10 years old.
But, you know, that's the tricky thing about mental illness. I was thinking about this case this morning, and I was thinking, you know, if what had happened to Mr. Hackett instead is that he'd been in a terrible car accident in 1988 and had become a quadriplegic as a result of it, I'm sure the Xerox people would have, you know, HI or its equivalent, would have reviewed each year, but nobody would have really questioned whether a 1989 report about his disability was still going to be valid in 2000 or any other time. Sadly enough, we aren't very good yet at fixing that kind of problem. Mental illness, much more difficult to know, and yet some forms of mental illness, once you have it, you have it. And it's hard to see an inconsistency in the reports until you get up to Dr. Holman.
Well, yes and no, Your Honor, because then he saw Dr. Bennett one time in 1992. He saw Dr. McGovern one time in 1995. And so Xerox, you know, has the benefit of that information over time.
But aren't they all pretty I mean, it's sort of interesting that all of these one-time visits keep coming to the same bottom line.
Yes, Your Honor, but they also all come to the bottom line, I believe, that this is not a permanent situation. This man can improve. This situation needs to be reevaluated and reassessed over time. There are ways this man can be helped, and that is the frustration that the administrative law judge Brundage has, He says, I think this can be looked at from when I read all of these reports. All of these doctors say that if this man will seek proper treatment, this can be taken care of. And I have serious doubts even now whether this man is disabled. He seems to have found a very comfortable lifestyle where he's traveling to Europe and getting married and going to exercise classes. He's very intelligent. He's perfectly physically capable. He had a great deal of skill. I don't know why this is going to be a permanent condition. And I think what Dr. Holman says is I've assessed this situation, and I don't think that at this point this man is in that condition. And I agree. He does not go through detail by detail and say, I'm going to discount this because it's 10 years old. I'm going to say that the economy has now changed and people are much more able to stay at home and work so they don't have to have personal interaction today as much as they may have had to have in 1989. But I think the other thing, Your Honor, to note is that Administrative Law Brunjean in 1995 basically ended his report by saying, in the interim, I suggest efforts be made at rehabilitation, including medication, as recommended, and that action started to breach the pattern of unemployment and idleness. And what we know from this administrative record is, Your Honor, almost from that point forward, Mr. Hackett quit even going to Dr. Gerber. Because Dr. Gerber says, I haven't seen this guy since January 1997. He only goes back when Dr. Holman comes back and says, I don't think this man's disabled. I've looked at these medical records. I've examined this man. I've talked with him. I don't think he's disabled. At that point, Mr. Hackett, for the first time in almost 2 years, goes back and gets Dr. Gerber to write a page and a half letter to him saying, I think he's still disabled. And then on April 28th, Dr. Gerber writes another letter, but says no more than that as well.
But Dr. Gerber's letters at that point do indicate that the Dr. Gerber, who does have the longitudinal view of Mr. Hackett's condition, thinks that he's no better and maybe even a little worse.
Well, Your Honor, that's true. He says that, but in every disability case that ever gotten before this court and under ERISA, there are two doctors who disagree, or else we wouldn't be here. If all the doctors agreed, the claim would have been approved. So that in and of itself is not enough.
But it's the lack of explanation. I mean, we do want to know in the Social Security cases and in these cases why the decision maker, some kind of understanding of why the decision maker chose to disregard or not credit or, disagree with one of the experts.
And in this case, Health International went with Dr. Holman and Dr. Wolf, both board-certified psychiatrists, one who had examined him, both of whom had reviewed all of his medical records, including that of Dr. Gerber. I am not going to tell you that a reasonable man or woman couldn't have read all of this stuff and decided, I'm going to go with Dr. Gerber and I'm going to disregard Dr. Holman and Dr. Wolf. But that's not the standard we apply here. I think it's clearly whether HI acted arbitrarily and capriciously in deciding to affirmed the opinions and determinations by Dr. Holman and Dr. Wolf over those of Dr. Gerber. And I don't think that this court can find that that was a completely unreasonable choice by Health International when you have two board-certified psychiatrists who look at this history.
I'm sorry, go ahead. Mm-hmm.
But we say in Halperin, for us to have meaningful review, we have to have some sense of why the rejected position no longer holds. Is that just too stringent a standard that we have in this circuit?
With all due respect, Your Honor, I don't think that's exactly what Halpin says.
Let me tell you what Halpin says. We say, within reasonable limits, the reasons for rejecting evidence must be articulated if there is to be meaningful appellate review.
Well, I think that what the purpose of Halpin is to say that Mr. Hackett is entitled to know why his claim is being rejected so that he can put up a case to refute it. We gave him Dr. Holman's 7-page report, and we said, this is why your claim is being denied. So he understood why it was being denied, and when you look at the stuff he submitted in response to that, he understood that because he takes great tasks. Or takes Dr. Holman to task about some of his conclusions. And he goes out and gets Dr. Gerber to submit 2 more reports which go after Dr. Holman's opinion. So he fully understood why his claim was being denied, and he was given a full and fair opportunity to refute that. And I think that you would say, well, that substantially complies. That's what we are concerned about. I don't believe, when you read the Amico case and the Donato case, I don't think it was incumbent upon Dr. Holman to go through, here are the 6 points that were made by the physicians in 1989, and here's each and every reason why.
Do they go through any point of refutation regarding the earlier physician?
Your Honor,
other than the ultimate conclusion, that in a temporal sense, that today one doctor says okay and the other says not. That position would be then any competent in the sense of license, no charges pending, any, the last doctor rules. I mean, if we don't have any sense of analysis by the last doctor as to the preceding physician's assessment.
Well, I guess
under your position, they received, Mr. Paulser, all the earlier work by the review by the early physician. I'm not questioning a presumption that all that was reviewed and read and fed into the conclusion. But all we have is this conclusion, right? I mean, the ultimate conclusion of not disabled. And are we supposed to just read in a refusal to acknowledge the Gerber position? I mean, it's implicit it's rejected, but we just say, well, it was rejected by another competent physician, so that trumps it.
Well, I think that there are two things. First of all, I think if you look at the administrative record at page 78, Dr. Holman does go through Dr. Gerber's most recent report and says, you know, I read this. I don't agree with his access to determination. But the other thing is, this is the mental illness. This isn't like a cardiological problem where the guy says, you know, I've looked at this x-ray and he thinks that this is occluded. I don't agree. He thinks this bone is broken. I don't. He thinks this tumor is going to grow. I don't think it is. The mental illness puts it in a different ballpark. I mean,
couldn't Dr. Holman have said that Dr. Gerber's contemporary analysis has a dated view? Obviously it's hypothetical. It doesn't take into account some of the factors you mentioned in the workplace today. I mean, do we have any of that? Any of a sense that HI's doctor was responsibly critical of the position of Dr. Gerber, I guess? Other than a rejection of his current conclusion.
Other than the second letter, which is in the administrative record, in which he had gone back and reviewed the medical records after Dr. Gerber had sent them. He says, I've looked at these, and I've looked at this 1989 neurological physical examination. I, however, would diverge from those prior opinions in the area of disability based solely upon an access to diagnosis and move specifically in this case in light of the subject's failure to pursue treatment, his engagement in other protective pursuits, and the lack of any effort to have the subject work in over 10 years in any of the varying work environments. That's what he says. Now, is that taking Dr. Gerber's opinion apart to the extent that you want? I'm not certain, but I think that it shows that he considered it, and this was his rationale for making a conclusion different than that of Dr. Gerber's. See that my time is up. I ask the court to affirm all of Judge Norgal's determination.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Mr. Dabowski.
The situation is even worse here than what you just suggested a minute ago, Chief Judge Flom. This is not a situation where it's just Dr. Holman rejecting Dr. Gerber. The entire record contains no information whatsoever that anybody oversaw this process and said, okay, here's what Gerber says, here's what Holman says, we're going to accept this, we're going to reject this. This was just absolutely contrary to the whole notion of what ERISA says that plan administrators are supposed to do.
Why should we presume, Mr. Dabowski, that the administrator didn't assess Dr. Holman's findings as against the other? What proof do we need that the administrator failed to make that appropriate comparison in your view?
The proof is the entire absence from the record of any such documentation. There is absolutely no indication in this record that there was any weighing that took place. If there had been, this would probably be an entirely different case. This case is distinguishable from Halpin in that regard, because in Halpin, at least there was an administrator who purportedly weighed the evidence but didn't articulate the reasons for rejecting evidence. The only other distinction between this case and Halpin is Halpin's use of an arbitrary and capricious standard of review, which we contend was improperly applied in this case, because the plan under which Mr. Hackett had gone out on disability on should have governed the outcome of this case. But regardless, even if this court does stick with an arbitrary and capricious standard of review, this court has clearly articulated what that means. In an arbitrary and capricious review means that there was no reasoned explanation for the decision. There is no reasoned explanation in this record. All that Mr. Hackett got was a letter that said, not clinically supported. Also, this court has said in the Hess case that when there is a blatant disregard of the applicant's submissions, that is evidence that an arbitrary and capricious conduct had taken place in this case. And it's clear that Health International blatantly disregarded what Dr. Gerber had to say. Dr. Gerber's opinion was entirely consistent with every other medical doctor who would have been involved in this case. And with respect to Mr. Potler's point about this isn't like a cardiac case or there's no x-ray, Mr. Hackett had undergone two separate sessions of detailed psychological testing. One was by Dr. Hemrich in the late 80s. The second one was in 1995 by the other doctor, whose name escapes me now, Dr. McGovern. And those reports are remarkably consistent, which show, consistent with Dr. Gerber's opinions, that Mr. Hackett's condition was lifelong. Their own independent examiner, Dr. Bennett, said in 1994, this is lifelong. It will not respond to medication. It will not respond to treatment. Dr. Gerber's opinion confirming that was absolutely correct, and there was absolutely no basis for disregarding it. And for that reason, we're asking this court to reverse the court below and restore Mr. Hackett's benefits plus interest and attorney's fees. Thank you.
Thanks, Strasky. Thanks, Butler. The case is taken under advisement.